When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard. But by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of History Hack. We've got another exciting one for you today. I'm talking to Dr. Daisy Dunn, who is a classicist and historian and author of In the Shadow of Vesuvius, A Life of Pliny, of Gods and Men, 100 Stories from Ancient Greece and Rome. But we are not talking ancient history, because Daisy has got a really interesting new book out called Not Far from Brideshead, Oxford Between the Wars. We're basically going to be talking about Oxford University during this period, and basically the kind of mini war that happens within Oxford and the Oxford University as an institution in between the two world wars, which I was completely clueless about until this book landed on my lap. And it's a fascinating read. Daisy, welcome to History Hack. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for asking. Normally people don't care. They just sort of go, yeah, I'm fine. Can we move on and get on with the interview? Which we are promptly going to do. But unusually for History Hack, normally we jump sort of straight into the history, but I'm curious about this shift because, as I said in the intro, you're a classicist in terms of your training. Your previous works have been on ancient history. So what made you want to sort of dive into this story that's, you know, almost 2,000 years later and in a very sort of different corner of the world? What was the thinking behind it?
Well, this was a story that I actually happened upon completely by accident, I think. So, you know, as an author, the worst possible thing you can do is sort of finish a book and then be sitting at your desk thinking, oh God, I've got to write another book. What on earth do I write about next? And have that sort of agonizing few weeks or months or whatever it is, just trying to come up with an idea. I think sometimes the best ideas come to you quite organically over time without you even realizing it. And then suddenly they kind of click into place. And this is something that happened with this particular story. I went to a literary festival in North Yorkshire in 2016. I was giving a talk there and I thought, oh, when I'm up here, I'll go to Castle Howard because I hadn't been there before. And I knew of Castle Howard mainly through the televised series of Brideshead Revisited, which I think I watched as a teenager and quite enjoyed. But I hadn't anticipated of walking into the main hall and seeing quite so many works of art, of sort of classical arts, of emperor busts and sort of paintings inspired by Greek mythology and things like this. So I kind of went home and I was reading up on the kind of classical connections to Castle Howard, and I realised that Gilbert Murray, who was sort of the preeminent scholar in classics of the 20th century, he married into the family who lived in Castle Howard. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I kind of knew his name through sort of my student reading lists. And I started reading more and more into him and his role at Oxford and his circle. And it just sort of struck me that he and all these other people kind of connected me to all these other poets and writers of the age. So I hadn't really thought about from that perspective. So I thought it looked quite fun and quite sort of eccentric. And I mean, the fact is that one of the people I was writing about had served in the First World War, and he's kind of profoundly affected by that. And a lot of these people were working quite hard in Oxford to try and aid refugees from Nazi Germany, and the sort of the rise of Hitler sees classical history suddenly propelled into public consciousness because it's being subverted. So classics becomes a lot more central to the national conversation than you might think. So in a sense, the book wasn't so much of a departure for me as it appears on the surface.
I'm going to just pull on one of those threads that you've just kind of teased us with there, which is poets, not least T.S. Eliot, because that's where you start your book, right? With his experiences at the start of World War One in Oxford. And I think this is an important kind of scene setting for us to understand why the university undergoes this shift. Give us a sort of flavour of the way in which life changes within the university through the onset of the war, not just in terms of obviously the place kind of empties, right? Because lots of the undergrads go off to war, but, you know, the way in which the tempo of life also changes within the university.
Yes, so poor T.S. Eliot comes over to Oxford probably full of expectations of what it's going to be like. He arrives in 1914, and as you say, he finds it really emptying out as more and more students are going off to war. And lots of the sort of centuries-old traditions are having to change and adapt to the times because there aren't sort of the usual staff around for a start. So there's bigger gaps between meal times, which is sort of an irritation to some of the students, to say the least. One of the young men that T.S. Eliot befriends, this young man called E.R. Dodds, who became one of my protagonists in my book, he was his tutorial partner. They studied together. And he describes Oxford as being like a shrunken skeleton of a university at this time, because the British students are, you know, largely off away fighting. Those who are still remaining are kind of attending lectures in the morning and then having to go off and train in the afternoon with the officers' training corps. And so they're colloquially known as bug shooters, because supposedly they spend all of their afternoons lying around on their tummies, sort of shooting at insects in Christchurch Meadow. That's sort of the joke that was made within the university, and so doing musketry practice and things like this. And so The kind of makeup in the university changes around them at the same time. You have students coming in from overseas, you have more Rhodes scholars, more students from America, more students from Europe, more students from India arriving. And at the same time, because there are so sort of few people filling the colleges, rumours start to swell as the war goes on. So by 1917, certainly, rumours reach certain soldiers on the Western Front that Oxford might have to close because it's not going to be sustainable. And there's a really lovely letter that's been preserved at Wadham College, and it's from a student saying, I hope there's no truth to this rumour, because we'd think that it meant you were losing heart if Oxford was to close. So luckily it didn't close, but it did have to adapt and it did have to change, which was quite a shock for a traditional place like Oxford.
I mean, just in terms of student life and student culture, you know, things like team sports. Think about what do we really associate in terms of sporting connections with Oxford and Cambridge, of course, is famously the boat race. But when you have this mass exodus of students, all of the clubs also must sort of wither and sort of go into, at best, hibernation, if not cease to exist completely. So do you see this sort of the student life kind of changing, and how do the students themselves try and deal with that?
Well, that some of them have to try and sort of take up sort of rowing on their own or in small boats rather than the usual eight. And a lot of the other colleges are so filling up with people they haven't seen before. So there's a Belgian refugees, for example, arriving. There are Belgian school children being educated sort of within Oxford as well. And so the biggest change, I guess, which affects women more than men, and I would say there are far fewer women in the university at this time than men, but they're profoundly affected by the arrival of something called the Third Southern General Hospital, which arrives and takes over a lot of the university. It arrives at examination schools for a start, which is where students are used to doing their exams. These are absolutely enormous halls, and they're sort of perfect for wards. So it was sort of a natural place to, you know, to take the wounded in. And the town hall, likewise, that specialises in treating soldiers who are suffering from malaria. And Somerville, which is one of the five women's colleges at this time, that's based next door to the Oxford Radcliffe Infirmary. So they decide, the War Office just says, well, you know, it's convenient, let's knock a wall through so that soldiers who've been treated can then kind of use that as a convalescence home. So that means that all the women students have to sort of move out and be rehoused. So that's a big change. And you have Robert Graves and Siegfried Sassoon and people all being treated there. And there's some wonderful photographs, sort of tents being erected on the lawns to try and maximise the space, and sort of soldiers relaxing in the portico outside the library, trying to get some sun and kind of recuperate. And then there's a sign put up in the dining hall saying that officers are requested not to throw custard at the walls, which is rather funny. So the place looks very different. The women have to go off to Oriel, which is a male college. They're put in their own little separate quad, and there's kind of like a barricade put between them, and the sort of a local journalist compares them to being sort of bricked up like medieval nuns, and the men kind of try to break through into their quarter, and it becomes sort of a bit of a challenge for them. So the place does change quite dramatically.
Wow. You talk there a lot about sort of, in a sense, Oxford trying to do its bit during the conflict. Is there that sense very early on that the university has a role to play within the wider war effort, or is this something that develops out of necessity with the passage of time?
I think at the very beginning of the war, there's a lot of sort of recruiting going on in Oxford. There's St Giles, which is this long road which leads out from Oxford, and there's a fairground there. There's been sort of a fair there every September, and there's sort of a lot of recruiting happening there. Thousands of people sort of, you know, all sign on. So that's happening early on, but sort of the hospital arrives sort of slightly later into the war. And I think there is a sort of real desire on the part of the people who are there, you know, to do something, to feel needed. Vera Brittain, she's a great author of Testament of Youth, wonderful wartime memoir. She was one of the students at Somerville. And she said, even though she was studying there and she wanted to go to Oxford, she felt like it was almost irrelevant in a way. She felt like she needed to be doing something, which is why she left to become a nurse. She later went back to Oxford. So I think there's a kind of an anxiety, and I think we can really relate to that, especially now. You kind of want to do something to help, you know, even though you don't necessarily know the right way to do it.
Let's take it forward a little bit in time to sort of the post-war period, because as I teased at the start, and as you know, the focus of your book really is, Oxford kind of finds itself in a conflict in a different sense, doesn't it? In the interwar period, as we now think of it. Of course, they don't know it as the interwar period. But you've got lots of factions, differing pressures, a move to bring about change, which in itself ends up being contested and a hell of a lot more besides. So let's start with the divide within the lecture theatre, first of all. And this is the one that perhaps surprised me the most when I was reading your book, because you've got a division that you kind of really nicely illustrate in at the start of, I think it's the second chapter, between those who had served and those who hadn't. Talk us through that divide, how it kind of looked and felt, and the impact that had within the halls, within the lecture theatres themselves.
Well, Oxford looked incredibly hierarchical after the war in a way that it hadn't before. It's a really sort of strange mix of people across the year groups and immediately after the war. If you think about it, you have sort of schoolboys coming up straight from school, who obviously they've been sort of too young. They've come straight out of school, they're arriving in Oxford and sort of discovering independence for the first time. They're sitting next to former soldiers and officers who have been, you know, deeply scarred in many cases by their experience. They have their own vernacular, they have their own language in which they describe things. The novelist Anthony Pohl describes them sort of describing the dining hall as mess and things like that. You know, they sort of have their sort of army slang, which they bring to Oxford. And then you have these students who've been up all the way through the sort of rare survivals from before the war, who Morris Bowra, who's one of my classics dons that I focus on, he describes them as the brontosaurs. The sort of the old dinosaurs who've been there from before. And I mean, this kind of weird mix and combination of people who are often quite segregated within the dining halls, it's very, very obvious to people who are there. Vera Brittain, who I've mentioned a few moments ago, she sort of described the young men who were there sort of oscillating between this kind of profound inferiority complex in front of the officers who had fought, and this kind of determination to make themselves felt by being sort of as noisy as possible. So there, it sort of has a dramatic effect, I think, this gulf between the men and the boys.
Do you see sort of conflict, and does it end up sort of spilling out into more than just sort of an almost cultural divide? Do you sort of see, you know, people having a little bit too much to drink, and those divisions sort of spilling over into fights in the quads or equivalents like that?
Definitely so, yes. I mean, one of the things we sort of associate with Oxford, unfortunately, today is the Bullingdon Club. And that was still very much, you know, around in this period. And you have these rather, you know, privileged students joining this group and burning each other's furniture in the college quads and sort of creating mischief and sort of handing over a check the next day, you know, as if that would make everything all right again. And that's not necessarily sort of being carried out on students who fought and against those who haven't, but there's a kind of general atmosphere of liberation and sometimes of going too far. And I think we can look at that and we can be rightly so quite hard on Bullingdon Club type antics today, but I think in the immediate aftermath of the war we kind of see them slightly differently. You know, we're looking at people who have been thrown into, you know, from one extreme to another, entering this kind of strange university after the trenches. It must be a very, very kind of destabilizing experience. So I think the time really had made a deep impression on the people who were there.
I was going to ask about exactly that point. You know, how much of this is, you know, class being an issue between sort of the aristocratic lifestyle, your Bullingdon Club types and equivalents, compared to sort of the more bourgeois existence that is gradually becoming perhaps more typical of those who are starting to go to Oxford during this period? Obviously, that's a trend that takes a long time to follow through. But I think it would be fair to say that this is one of those points where you start to see that shift happening, right?
It is, yes. So, I mean, if we look at the demographic of Oxford today, it's completely unlike that at the beginning of the First World War. So I think it was in 2020, almost 70% of undergraduates at Oxford were state educated. About 64% of graduates came from overseas. And that wasn't the case at all. So in the beginning of the period I'm writing about, it's about three quarters of the male students have been privately educated in art subjects. And there are hardly any women there anyway, but about half of those were the same. And, you know, very small, about 5% from the Commonwealth, 5% from sort of elsewhere overseas. So it's not terrifically diverse, but this begins to change between the wars. This sort of mentions of more scholars coming in from overseas during the First World War, and this sort of general trend which kind of picks up, especially during the Second World War. It becomes a little bit more diverse, and more women as well coming in with degrees, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But I mean, I think you can say to yourself, okay, so why today would we sort of sit down and even think about sort of writing about these people when, you know, so many of them seem to be from a similar privileged background? But I think what interested me was the fact that even though many of these students had a very comfortable upbringing and they had a sort of very comfortable student life, you know, ostensibly arriving at Oxford, a beautiful place, beautiful buildings, first rate teaching, nice food, everything else, but I mean, war had an effect of obliterating all of that. It kind of made sort of people's backgrounds irrelevant in many ways. It's sort of the great leveler in a way that sort of no amount of privilege could really kind of protect these thousands of young men who've been studying at Oxford from being thrown into the deep end. You know, it changed that dynamic completely, and sort of part of what I was trying to do in my book is to look at how these young people adjusted from that hell to liberation within the city and whether that was possible.
Can I ask about new ideas coming in as well during this period, particularly sort of thinking about how across Europe there are concerns about the rise of communism during this period? And today we tend to associate universities with more radical, heavily emphasizes in inverted commas there, but certainly more radical, particularly more left-leaning ideals, which isn't necessarily always the case. Sometimes is, sometimes isn't. But do you see that at play? Because universities are meant to be the places where these ideas are discussed, right? That's part of the point of them. Whether it's within philosophy, whether it's within historical context or other forms. So do you see that kind of creating a tension where you see a sort of a growth of interest within Marxism and communist ideals within the university, and then others perhaps coming from your sort of Bullingdon Club type background who push back on that? Is that an issue as well during this period?
Certainly you see sort of a conflation of different ideals coming about. So there's one group in particular, there's a classics don who I focus in on, Morris Bowram, who is the one who described the Brontosaurus at Oxford. And he kind of takes a number of students under his wing, and he kind of forms this really very sort of anti-establishment group. So they're sort of pushing against what they believe sort of the conservative government of the time represented, and trying to be a lot more sort of liberated in the way that they went about their own lives. And so they're pro sort of mischief. They describe themselves as being sort of very open to homosexual students, to Jewish students, to sort of whole groups of people who might feel marginalized at that time otherwise. So you have that kind of arising as a kind of undercurrent. You have, again, as you said, this is more traditional Bullingdon type representation as well. And then you have sort of a mix of other people who I think are drawing a lot on what's happening in Europe and looking at sort of European scholarship and writing, and particularly in the classical world, is Germany is the place where a lot of sort of the leading scholarship is being produced. And there are sort of relationships being forged between German scholars and English scholars at Oxford. And I think, I mean, that's something which in some cases definitely becomes disrupted by the First World War and then the Second World War as well. So it's an interesting kind of time, actually, if you're looking at the relationships that were being forged between sort of Britain and Europe.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I want to, if we may, talk about female students who you've alluded to already over the course of this. Give us a sense of the struggles that female students are facing. It goes without saying that prior to the First World War, we were in the era of the suffrage struggle, right? That only starts to change come 1918. So for these female students, trying to be recognised as equals is in itself a huge challenge. And I'm not just talking about securing the education, but also the recognition that comes off the back of it. You know, this idea that you can secure a double first in classics or whatever it might be, and then find it really hard to get employment within that field. So just talk us through those challenges and the efforts to try and overcome that.
Mm. Well, the women really face an uphill struggle to be accepted and to be sort of embraced on an equal footing with the men. They'd been sort of at Oxford as students for years, but it was only 1910 that they were formally even recognised as sort of members of the university itself. And then throughout this period, they're studying the same subjects as the men, they're doing the same papers, examination papers, the same lectures, the same everything. And they don't get degrees, they get a sort of a certificate at the end. And it's only 1920, and they finally win this sort of long campaign in order to get degrees. So degrees are sort of awarded to some women sort of retrospectively. And that's in place. And you think, okay, this is a great breakthrough for women in 1920. By 1927, a quota is then imposed on the number of female undergraduates allowed to study at Oxford. So it's about 840 allowed in. So for roughly for sort of every five or six men, there's one woman. So, and that quota, I mean, it's raised by about 100 and something in the 1940s, but it stays in place until 1957. So, and then like a lot of the male colleges not open their doors to women until the about the 1970s and 1980s. It seems it's very, very slow progress. And that sense of frustration is really reflected in women's writing at the time. You see them really sort of pushing against it. And I mean, there are like editorials in the Times and things, people saying, oh, you know, if women are really allowed to get degrees, I think they're going to have to work a little bit harder and, you know, be subject to stricter discipline than, you know, is currently in force. It's a very sort of negative attitude towards women having any kind of progress, and they're just constantly being knocked back. And I think this is frustrating for some of the more forward-looking men in Oxford as well. I mean, Gilbert Murray, this leading Greek professor at Oxford, he says that the women are actually much more extraordinary than the average of the men who are studying there. And he's irritated by it, but there's not a lot that sort of one person can do individually. There's a whole culture against them. And I think maybe that stays with them, that carries on when they try and find work later. I think particularly as a writer myself, I'm always looking at sort of the challenges that women faced who were trying to be writers in that period. And, you know, there was a real kind of attitude that women who wanted to write or become journalists were aggressive or masculine, and it wasn't seen as a kind of acceptable pursuit. So it is actually very frustrating looking back on it as a woman as to how slow change was.
Yeah, good job that this is a radio show, because it's at moments like this when on History Hack, some certain rude hand gestures tend to get made with reference to the patriarchy. It's just staggering, particularly what you say about how, you know, it's as late as the 70s that some of these colleges actually open their
doors.
Even the
80s and some of them, yeah.
Just incredible. And this idea that they're going to have to work harder because they're women. They have to work harder anyway because you're imposing a quota that means that there are fewer places for these women. So inevitably, what you were saying about that idea that actually the standard amongst the female students is higher is probably true, because you take the best, right? That's how these institutions work. And so if you've got fewer options, it's inevitable. Sorry, I'm going off on a rant.
No, I agree. It makes me really impassioned. I was just sitting when writing this book, I was just feeling so cross so much of the time. But I think you you need to feel cross, because you have to sort of understand, you know, what happened. And you feel just so empathetic, I think, with all of those poor women who are just trying. You know, there must be so many who were turned away and being amazing women, and he would have been, you know, held back. It's just incredibly frustrating.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Off the top of your head, sorry, I'm just sort of throwing this one in there. Do you happen to know who the first female lecturer is at Oxford and when she's appointed?
Yes, so there was the first female don. It was in the 1800s, and she was known colloquially as the Rog. Her name was, I think it was Annie Rogers. I'll just double check that. And she was actually a classicist, and she became sort of the first kind of Dawn in Oxford, and she was from, I think her father was a sort of clergyman, and so she grew up in Oxford itself, and I think was quite familiar with its ways, and maybe that helped sort of aid her progress. But I mean, she was sort of an anomaly, you know. Even sort of decades later, there weren't that many, and women were employed by their sort of various colleges rather than the actual faculty, the actual sort of departments. So they weren't on an equal footing with the men who were employed to teach either. So it was kind of disparity everywhere.
Something else that is bound to ignite passions when it comes to sort of understanding this period is that sort of long looming shadow that dominates this period in the form of the rise of fascism and the far right. And history often ends up becoming a plaything of political agendas across the entire political spectrum, it has to be said. And it is manipulated and twisted in many cases to suit those agendas. Now, Oxford, Cambridge, these institutions that are places of learning, they're often seen as sort of places that have a responsibility in times such as that to try and push back against that sort of insidious manipulation of the past. So how does that affect the dynamic, and what do the lecturers end up sort of having to do in order to try and push back against that misinformation that's being spread?
Well, a lot of this is coming out of sort of Nazi Germany. I mean, Hitler himself was really interested in classical history. He was looking at the Spartans in particular. He sort of saw them as a pillar of strength and something that sort of modern Germans should be aspiring to. And he wrote something called the Zweitesbuch in 1928, the secret book, which was published only posthumously. And he was praising in this sort of the ancient Spartan practice of sort of exposing sick children and sort of a racial preservation, sort of building up a military state and things like that. And it's all very much, the history is taken out of context and subverted. And this is immediately of concern to scholars who actually work in these fields. And I mean, they had to sort of try and kick back against a lot of what's happening, because even from school level in Germany, pupils are being given sort of passages of Tacitus to look at, sort of describing the Germans as being sort of very sort of robust and strong. And it's all being sort of, they're being indoctrinated from a very, very young age. And it's sort of happening sort of in the sporting world as well. You find Hitler being sort of attracted to ancient sculptures of, you know, these sort of white marble, we actually know they were painted, but you know, these sort of white marble sculptures of the time, and sort of looking at them as sort of figures of strength. And then Plato again being really heavily mined by Nazis for sort of propaganda, looking at sort of Plato's Republic, sort of arguments for euthanasia being extracted from this, again, kind of out of their original context. And as a result of this, as a scholar at the time, he actually said something like a revulsion grew up towards Plato as a result of the way that he was being contorted in Germany. So classicists and philosophers and other scholars had a real battle on their hands to try and reclaim, to resalvage these elements of history and the historical past, and to present them as they really were. And as a scholar who said, you know, with authors like Plato, you need to kind of arm yourself with a stout pair of blinkers, and then you can prove that Plato can be anything you want him to be. These people, the work could be incredibly malleable. So people were pushing back against this sort of real destruction and abuse, really, of classical history. And that's partly why classics become such an important integral subject in this period.
Yeah, I think that's true of many sections of history where you have a significant body of source material. Certainly I could point to 19th century figures who, if they wrote prolifically, you end up being able to take pretty much anything out of a context that it's given, and you can spin it to support any which way. So I'm not surprised in the slightest by what you say there. I'm really glad you picked up on the painted statues thing. There is a certain irony in that just complete misunderstanding of what these statues actually looked like originally. Let's move away from fascism now and talk about sort of the internal pressure, if we rather than sort of the broader external changes in society pressure, the internal struggle within the university for the dons. Let's start with just kind of explaining for those who aren't familiar with the academic terminology what a don is. But how do the lecturers, the researchers at Oxford sort of, what are the points of contention between them as individuals? And perhaps, sort of give us a few examples of those individuals and the factions, if you will.
Well, with dons, I'm talking sort of colloquially, talking about academics within the university, talking about lecturers, tutors, researchers, head of department. And there's kind of hierarchy of those, as there is still today. You have the really senior ones, so the big cheese in my book, the Gilbert Murrays, who's the sort of Regius Professor of Greek. And this was a position that really interested me in this book because I couldn't really think of kind of coming across something like this before. This was a crown appointment. So it was sort of steered by the prime minister in consultation with the monarch of the time. And it was kind of shrouded. It wasn't a position you could apply to be. You can't sort of fill out a form and say, I want to be this professor. It's something you're kind of headhunted for from the very, very top. And it was a newsworthy item in these days. So, this is interesting. I hadn't really, considered that this kind of thing actually existed. And it was interesting looking at these sort of cuttings from the period where people were saying, who's going to be the next Regius Professor at Oxford? And I thought, I can't imagine this happening today. And I sort of partly hooked some of my story around this because Gilbert Murray is retiring from this position. And the question arose in the press and across Oxford as to who would replace him, who would take his job. And there are various sort of obvious candidates, and there are some less sort of obvious, that's kind of the wild card candidate as well. And there's a huge drama that bubbles up when the job goes to one of them and not the person that everyone thinks it ought to have gone to, or the person that everyone's expecting it to go to. And so the kind of poor, cuckolded member of this kind of circle is the one who ends up making the other one's life hell. And there's a kind of mini war, as he puts it, sort of between this sort of circle of dons, which is quite funny. You get sort of one of them writing quite rude poetry, and sort of you get quite unpleasant things as well of, John saying you shouldn't go to this guy's lectures and sort of try and dissuade their students from attending the lectures of this. And since this guy enters the dining room, everyone walks out, and it becomes like a real drama in Oxford. It's one of those really, and I think it's quite sort of amusing, some of it to read about. But at the same time, it was utterly unpleasant for the poor person involved. And I mean, tensions. Partly in this, I think another thing which interested me was that within these figures, there was a bone of contention, the fact that some of them had served in the war and others were conscientious objectors. And that becomes sort of a major difference. And those who'd served felt a sort of a superiority over those who hadn't. And that ended up being sort of a big gulf between them. And Oxford just gets carried away. It's kind of split into two rival camps, essentially, as a result of this, the fallout of this contest for this job, which everybody seems to want.
Wow. Just wow. I mean, it sounds more like an episode of The Only Way is Essex than it does what you'd expect of an institution like Oxford. I've heard of departmental rivalries in my time, but that's on another level entirely. I'm curious about, why is it a crown appointment? With the best will in the world, the king, the prime minister, these aren't people who I would have thought are particularly au fait with the classics and, be best placed to determine who's suitable for that post. Why is that a thing?
Well, this is another of these old Oxford traditions which have been in place for years, for centuries, in fact. It's Henry VIII who set up these Regius Professors, and there's a Regius Professors in various subjects of theology, for example. And the classics one, the Greek one, was seen as the absolute sort of number one that everyone wanted. And so I think in the early days, it was essentially the monarch who'd often sort of appoint someone who they thought, oh, they're jolly nice, or they're sort of very heroic, and there's someone who gets appointed because he's very brave and undergoing a leg amputation, not necessarily because he was a great classicist. So you have this sort of thing happening, and then over time it becomes more and more the prime minister's responsibility and less the monarch's. But still today, it's kind of a royal letters painting that gets sent to you, the chosen candidate, and the queen has to give her okay to the appointment.
It's all very curious, isn't it? this story, it was the basis, because you mentioned this earlier, didn't you? Brideshead Revisited, Evelyn Waugh, this is the basis for all of that. Is that right? And am I right in thinking that some of the characters within the book were people that he actually knew within this whole thing that's playing out?
So the story of this contest for the job isn't part of Brideshead Revisited, but one of the people involved in it did inspire one of the characters in Brideshead Revisited. So there's the connection. So Maurice Bowerer is one of the people who wants this job, and he was the inspiration for Mr. Sam Gross in the novel, who is this rather, like, it's very difficult to take to Mr. Sam Gross in Evelyn Waugh's novel. He's very obsequious and treacly and everything else. He's not a sort of character that you warm to. But you sort of bear in mind that Evelyn Waugh didn't really know Bowerer until later in his life very well. And when he did, they had a very sort of strained relationship, and Evelyn Waugh was quite mischievous and kind of wanted to present Bowerer in a negative light. I mean, the real Bowerer was incredibly popular with students in his time, especially as a young man, and you don't get that looking at this portrait. But this is just the sort of thing that I guess novelists do. They look at people they know. When they're at Oxford, there are other characters in there as well. There's sort of Harold Acton and Brian Howard inspiring Anthony Blanche, sort of a very over-the-top character in Brideshead Revisited. And Harold Acton, we know actually he did read T.S. Eliot's poetry through a megaphone through the window, so that happens just as it does in the book. And Sebastian Flight goes around Oxford cuddling this teddy bear. In reality, it was John Betjeman, the poet, who went around carrying a teddy bear around Oxford. So, you know, as a novelist, he was picking up on things he remembered and things he knew as a student, and they all kind of went into this kind of stew pot that formed the novel.
Interesting. I always find it fascinating to look at that process of how authors draw on what they know as the basis for what they then write about. And it's always really interesting, whichever, you know, genre you're talking about, the extent of overlap between their lived experience and the experiences of their characters. Mm. I guess as we start to wrap this up, the obvious question, and it sounds like a simple one, is what's the outcome of it all? But I'm not sure it is a simple one to answer, because as we've sort of discussed, some of these are much bigger sort of societal transformational problems, right? So sure, you have the advent of World War II come 1939. Does that in some senses help to solve some of these problems? Does it move things forward that little bit faster? Does it provide sort of the sea change to bring about the resolution? Or, you know, is this a case that actually all of these rumble on until well into the 50s and the 60s?
This is a really interesting and complex question. I mean, one thing that interested me, particularly from a writing point of view, is that this whole sort of argument caused a huge amount of strife, which sort of rippled through Oxford. And I was interested in the way that this could just be sort of blown to dust and rendered completely trivial overnight, which it was initially by the coming of the Second World War. Suddenly that put everything into perspective, and people were realising that they were fussing over, you know, tiny little details, and these kind of, you know, little attacks they're making on each other just didn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. But that said, you have the war, and then after the war, you're still seeing the aftermath of a lot of this, and so the enmities that people built up towards each other. It seems to be quite lasting in some cases. And I wonder if that's partly because people found it almost comforting to go back to something that was preoccupying them before the war, before the whole kind of world fell apart again, you know, in the Second World War. It was more comforting to focus on petty rivalries and trivialities than it was to actually reflect on the big disaster and the big horror that they'd lived through. So I think maybe that's sort of part of human nature.
Interesting. But as you say, in the case of sort of the push to, I'm not even going to say democratize education for women, but just to be human about the whole thing. And I'm going off into a rant. Perhaps this is something that we're going to need to cut from the final edit. But that process of change for women goes on for a heck of a long time before it's actually resolved, right?
It does. Yeah. So in the 50s, the quota is finally lifted. But even then, I wouldn't say that women were anywhere near on an even footing with the men. And I think, there are certain quarters, even when I was a student, where I felt like in certain quarters, men felt a lot more prominent and dominant in certain areas than women were. And trying to sort of get positions, in like the junior common room, for example, I felt like some of that felt not in my particular college, because I was all female in mine until the end. But in others, through friends, it seemed quite a macho atmosphere in some ways. And I think that's probably leveled out and changed a little bit since I was a student. But I think the legacy of this has been quite long lasting.
Yeah, certainly when it comes to academic appointments, that trying to secure a gender balance is an ongoing concern within not all fields, but certainly within certain fields, it remains an issue, as it does within society as a whole. Daisy, this has been such an interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us. So, not far from Brideshead, Oxford Between the Wars is out already. We were just discussing that it seems to be doing pretty well, which is great news. Congratulations. Folks, you'll be able to get it from the History Hack bookstore or from relevant retailers, just as you know from my usual rants, please not Amazon, because we would like Daisy to actually see some of the profits and not Jeff Bezos cash in on, the latest installment of rocket fuel that he requires. That rant aside, please do, one way or another, go and buy this book. It's a really interesting read. Daisy, your other works on Roman history, again, obviously widely available online, well, Roman and Greek history, I should say. But you also have a website. Where can people find out more about your work and kind of stay in touch with developments about you?
Yes, my website is www.daisydunn.co.uk, and I tweet at Daisy F. Dunn.
And it's Dunn with a double N, folks. Full details in the description to this episode. Daisy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great fun.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.